I think today's Chautauqua will be very interesting. We thought it'd be a great idea to get some of our Chicago planners together to talk about what they're doing in other parts of the world. And so our speakers today will be Peter Kendall of Adrian Smith Gordon Gill Architects LLP. He will be speaking on China. And then Richard Wilson of Skidmore, Owings, and Merrill will speak on India. Christine Carlisle will speak, of Solomon, I should say, Corwell Fins, will speak on India. I'm sorry, Saudi Arabia. And then Nan Zhao will speak on China again. They will each take the mic. We're asking that that we hold our questions and answers to the end of the presentations, just to give everyone the opportunity to present their wonderful work to the body, the membership. I'd like to give you sort of a quick bio on each panelist, and then I'm going to turn it over to the panelists and let them entertain us. Peter Kendall is the licensed architect and director of urban design for Adrian Smith Gordon Gill Architects, a firm committed to the practice of sustainable architecture and urbanism. With training in landscape architecture, Mr. Kendall strongly emphasizes ecological sustainability in his projects. ASGG's large-scale projects are focused on merging energy management, carbon reduction, and environmental stewardship, and often involve technical collaborations with positive energy practice. AS and GG's groundbreaking decarbonization plan for Chicago's central area was awarded a national 2011 AIA Honor Award for urban design and planning. Projects on which Peter has provided design leadership have been recognized in 8 national awards from the American Institute of Architects, Urban Land Institute, and the Congress of New Urbanism, numerous local recognitions. And we welcome Peter to the panel to speak again on China. Our second panelist will be Richard Wilson. And Richard is the director of city design practice for Skidmore, Owings, and Merrill here in Chicago, and a proud member of Lambda Alpha since 2006. Richard served as principal consultant for the preparation of the Chicago Central Action Plan and for the Beijing Central Business District Expansion Plan, which this year's recipient of the AIA National Award for Regional and Urban Design. Last year, Richard lived in India for 9 months, directing the plan for a new city for 2 million people in the National Capital Region of Delhi. Construction of that city is now underway. He is currently directing a mixed-use project for 35 million square feet in Delhi and leading the design of a new city empowered by renewable energy in Saudi Arabia. Our next speaker will be Christine Carlisle. And Christine is both a planner and an architect with over 25 years of experience in planning, urban design, and architecture. Since founding Solomon Cordwell and Benz Planning Studio in 2002, her work has focused on creating sustainable and livable communities locally and internationally. Recent projects at SCB address international issues with an emphasis on large-scale master plans, including projects in China, India, Bratislava, Slovakia, Abu Dhabi, United Arab Emirates, Doha, Qatar, I think that's how you pronounce it, and Haus, Saudi Arabia. Besides Lambda Alpha, Christine is currently involved with Chicago planning efforts with Great North Michigan Avenue Association, the Chicago Central Area Community, and the Urban Land Institute. And our final speaker will be Nan Zhao, and Nan is a member of VOA. He has over 14 years of experience, including planning, commercial, high-rise residential, large-scale conference facilities, hotel, hospitality, and mixed-use projects in the U.S. and in China. Mr. Zhao joined VOA in 2000 and started VOA's China office in 2008. And without further ado, I'd like to welcome our panelists and begin the presentations.
All right.
No, it's really rough.
Levon, how do I advance the project? Is it? You guys have a? Just click this. Back is right.
Which one?
Okay. Well, thanks so much for being here. Again, my name is Peter Kendall. I'm Director of Urban Design with Adrian Smith Gordon Gill Architects, and it's great to present to you guys. I've also been a proud member, I don't think since 2006, but I did pay my dues today for the year. So I'm now a prouder member than I was this morning. I've had the privilege of working overseas, not only with Adrian Smith Gordon Gill, but with Skidmore. It's a lot of fun. We're doing some interesting work in China. So what I wanted to do today, it sounds like we've got a great panel and some great projects to look at. I just wanted to show you one project that we're doing in China. It's been occupying my time for the last 6 months, 6 to 9 months. And it's called Great City, which is sort of a funny name for an actually really interesting concept. And we were approached by a developer in China to design this, what they call a city. It's really a very, very large project on the outskirts of a city. And they gave us some requirements for the project. They wanted it to be in 1 square kilometer, which is just over about a half mile square, about the size of the Loop. But they wanted to have it hold 100,000 people. So imagine 100,000 residents in a half mile area. And the reason they wanted to do this is they wanted to define a new prototype for building residential development in China. There's a strong need in China for middle class housing. There is a lot of high end housing, but for the middle class Chinese, their income levels have not caught up with housing prices yet. So there's actually a shortfall of middle-class housing in China. So that was what this project was interested in addressing. And one of the reasons they came to us was because of the work we had done with the decarbonization plan in downtown Chicago. They knew that we had sort of an energy focus. They wanted to have Great City be a energy-efficient, sustainable project, sort of a new prototype for Chinese urbanism. So we said, that sounds great. So one of the things we did first was we developed a prototype of this city. And we just said, okay, let's take the 1 square kilometer, let's put 100,000 people in it. The other requirement they gave us was they set the FAR at 6.0 as a target FAR, which over a square kilometer equals 60 million square feet. So that's almost as much area as is in the Loop. So to no one's surprise, it kind of looks like the Loop. And I think our Chicago roots really showed up in this plan. We kept it pretty much on a grid. But we just wanted to test it out and see what this thing looked like. So we went ahead and did that. So we developed a prototype in the first month. We also incorporated a lot of sustainable attributes to the city. We had a buffer area that was designed. They told us that not only would the city be 1 square kilometer, but there would be a 3 square kilometer buffer zone around the city, and that would be for agriculture, for stormwater management, things like that. These are just a few more of the statistics. Again, we then received an actual location for this city. So we had our prototype. We now had a location. That location turned out to be Chengdu, which is in southwest China. I kind of call it the Denver of China. because it's in the middle of the country. It's right at the foot of the Himalayas. But unlike Denver, it has about, I think, 15 million people in it, so it's about twice the size of Chicago. So anyway, these were some of the statistics of the Chengdu site. It's about 3.6 kilometers. We still kept that idea of 1 square kilometer in the middle. And I'm sorry, still figuring this out. But we still set the population at 100,000 people, which was about 55,000 adults. So we did do some demographic profiling of the city. We thought it would generate about 51,000 jobs. Another criteria that the client gave us was that the city needs to be self-sustaining in terms of its economic profile. So we've got a few less jobs than we do have working adults, so there would be some people coming into the city. So anyway, we figured out all the numbers, we kind of did our prototype, and we had a site, so we were all ready to go. We got the site in January, and this is the site location. It's shown here on the outskirts of Chengdu. This is downtown Chengdu. We're about 25 kilometers from the city center. And the concept behind Great City is that it's really an edge city. And it would be an edge center in this larger Chengdu metropolis. And it would be transit accessible, but it would provide all the basic services a middle-class Chinese person would want in a city. So the city plan is organized around 8 themes, which capture the core attributes of the design that we're trying to put forward. I'll walk you through each of these. But it helps us organize the project a little bit because it's so complicated and dense. So the first theme was vertical density, and this was really in a response to the client's directive of a vertical city, high-density living, taller buildings, and conservation of land. These are some of the principles that we first started with. So we got the site, which is here on the upper left. It's sort of this diamond-shaped. And the site actually has some really interesting characteristics. Right now it's farmland, but it has these very nice valleys that are shown here in the dark green. There's really 4 of them, 1, 2, 3, and then 4. But it also then has ridge lines, which we marked here in red, that form this cross in the middle of the site. The second thing we did is we said, okay, what is the image of the city, or what is the defining characteristic of this place? And one of the criteria the client gave us was they want Great City to be almost a branded environment. That's kind of a crass way of saying it, but they want it to be very distinctive visually. So we settled on this shape of a circle, which had a walking radius of about 600 meters, so that's about 7.5 to 8 minutes from the center. But that also allowed us to sort of work with this triangular shaped site, kind of softened and allowed the city to fit in there a little bit better. We then created an open space system which is located on those ridge lines, and that open space system connects the city together, provides amenities for the residents, and then we have a simple road system which brings you in to the center, and then each district has a district park. And then we subdivided that into very distinct parcels. One of the principles that we wanted to put out there to this developer, because they were a little bit over enamored with this idea of a mega structure, of a single sort of city form, was the idea of parcelization and being able to sell off parcels to partners in the future. Because with 60 million square feet, there's no way even the most wealthy developer can pull that off in the time frame that they were talking about, which is about 7 to 10 years they want to build this. So this is where the design stands as of today. This rendering is only about a few weeks old. But you can see there is a very strong vertical city center here. There's these 4 distinct neighborhoods around that city center. So there's five distinct districts, and then you can see the valleys that come in here, which would provide recreation and open space. One of the concepts we're putting out there is this idea of mix of uses vertically as well as horizontally. So this is a three-dimensional land use model, essentially. The yellow is residential. The red is either hotel or retail. The blue tends to be office. We also have a very big medical district to the north, which they were interested in providing. Ironically, or perhaps not ironically, but interestingly, one of the middle-class Chinese, good health care is actually very hard to come by. So one of the goals of Great City is also to provide fairly predictable and stable medical care. The second theme is what we call quality of life. This has to do with providing schools, parks, general amenities that may not be available to the Chinese middle class in Chinese cities today. If you go to cities like Beijing or Shanghai, they're very exciting cities, very dynamic, but a lot of times they don't have the simple amenities that we take for granted, such as neighborhood parks, playgrounds, walkable streets, things like that. So quality of life had to do with those ideas. Here you see the open space system. We tied cultural or civic facilities to each of the district parks. We also had schools in here. The residential neighborhoods are shown here in yellow. The darker is the higher density, the lighter is lower. We arrayed the residential to the east, the south, and the west for sunlight. There's specific requirements in China on how much daylight every unit has to have throughout the day. So in a city of this density with buildings as tall, we have to be careful about shade and shadow. This is a rendering of one of those district parks. So you see a cultural building that may anchor that park, the taller residential structures around the perimeter. We've also designed lower podium buildings that define the street edge and provide a low-rise residential product along with some low-rise office. So it's not all just high-rise buildings coming down to the street. We've tried to create this middle level, podium level of mixed use. This is a rendering of one of the big park spaces adjacent to a school, which is here on the right. This particular park really serves the schools proper, so we showed a running track in there. But it shows that in certain portions of the city, the actual perceived height of the buildings, the perceived density, would not be all that different from a normal downtown condition here in the United States. We spent a lot of time designing the roads and the public right-of-way, which I'll talk about a little bit later. The third theme is what we called emerging economies. This has to do with job provision, as I talked about a little bit earlier. They had three or four key industries that they wanted to get in the city. Medical, as I mentioned, digital media. They're really fixated on vertical farming. I'm not quite sure why, but they love vertical farming, this particular client. So we've been studying vertical farming very extensively. There's only like one project of it built in the world, so we have one case study that we've been looking at. So anyway, this is the medical district on the north side of the city. Again, you see the district park, which organizes the tall buildings. They actually are very serious about this medical thing. I'm still not sure how they're going to pull it off because they want to do a Mayo-type environment here, and they're actually have visited Mayo Clinic. We took them on a tour of Northwestern Hospital, which they were very impressed with, the whole hospital complex. They're looking for partners to build this with them. So if anyone wants to expand their health offerings in China, I've got some people you can talk to. But anyway, we've been trying to integrate this. This is some of the vertical farming that we've been looking at. Interestingly, we still get confused about vertical farming. You actually don't need daylight to do vertical farming. It's all grown with artificial lighting. You can grow it, do it in your basement if you want. I'm sure some of you have done that already. And then online gaming, this is also very big in China. What's interesting about China, and is that they've got, there's a whole parallel universe of digital technology where they've got their own eBay, they've got their own PayPal, they've got their own online gaming companies, and what our client wants to do is partner with some of these digital companies that are really based out of China and develop city management tools and other amenities for the city. The fourth theme is pedestrian mobility. This has to do with the design of the public realm, which I mentioned earlier, but we're now just getting into some of the details of designing the streets, but we're looking to provide stormwater management in the streets. We've designed the street to be over 50% of the right-of-way cross-section is devoted to non-motorized transportation, so it's either landscaping, pedestrian movement, or bicycles, and they're on board with that. They also have a fixation with our particular client with what they call vertical integration or vertical planning. So we've been looking at underground, sort of a Wacker Drive model, underground service tunnels, but as anyone who's tried to build these things knows, it's extremely expensive not only to build but to maintain over time. So we're trying to steer them a little bit away from a lot of these flashy but very expensive infrastructure items. So this is a view of one of the pedestrian streets that we call them pedestrian streets. They tend to be 30 meters wide. This one is actually a little wider, 40 meters. This is connecting the district park to the what we call the CBD or the city center, which is this complex of very tall buildings here. But with 100,000 people in one square kilometer, we felt that these pedestrian-only streets would actually not only work well, but are necessary to relieve the pedestrian pressure on the main streets. So there's a whole network of pedestrian streets which are basically offset or interspersed with the vehicular streets. As I mentioned, bicycle transportation, if you, even though the city's designed for walking and everything is walkable, obviously not everyone wants to walk or can walk, so we do have bicycle transportation lanes in the streets. We're talking about electric shuttles that connect the neighborhoods together. This is a cross-section of that CBD area or the city center area. So this is actually where we have two transit lines coming together. We have a regional light rail line, and which is shown north-south right here. And then the subway line, we're talking with the city about redirecting the subway line to come in to the city center, which would be right here. And that electric shuttle would simply connect the neighborhoods together. And then that light rail line is actually very critical. It then connects to Chengdu's existing airport, which is here, and in the future will connect to the future second airport that they're going to build. And then the subway gets you back down to downtown Chengdu. So we see transit as very critical to this concept. Obviously, once you're there, you can walk around, but we don't want everyone driving here. Hopefully, they'll take the train. The fifth theme is sustainable infrastructure. We did do, as Levon mentioned, we have a sister company called the Positive Energy Practice, which does exclusively energy modeling and analysis. They've been working with us to look at sun exposure. This diagram here shows surfaces of buildings receiving 1 hour of sunlight on December 21st, which is essentially the code in China, the minimum. And the other graphic over here on the lower right shows the cumulative sunlight on all vertical surfaces facing south. And then this shows sunlight on the ground. So because of the density and intensity of the city, we wanted to make sure that light and air were adequately provided. We did do a basic energy model on the city, and we're estimating that the city will be approximately 40% energy efficient, or will deliver a 40% energy reduction over standard practice in China. Underneath all the public streets are essentially utility corridors. They all lead to this parcel up here in the northwest part of the site, which is what we call the Eco Park. And in that parcel, we're going to have consolidation of recycling center, biofiltration system for gray water and black water, and then also it's going to be the energy plant for the city. So we were able to put all that stuff into a fairly small area due to emerging technologies. So here you see a view from the northwest. This actually is that eco park right here, this big building. We're really still in the architectural design. We're just starting the architectural design of the buildings. That's why they all look a little monotonous. And that was one thing we were actually criticized a little bit on, is the architectural design needs to be amped up a little bit. So the sixth theme is natural systems. We divided the site into two systems of landscapes. The interior of the 1 square kilometer is what we call the urban landscape, and the exterior is what we call the natural landscape. And they both have different functions and different roles to play in the design of the city. This shows a view of the edge of the city, what we call the edge parcel. So you can see the buffer area, the outside landscape, the natural landscape out here, and then you actually enter the city in a very sort of controlled way. I won't say it's a wall, but there's a very distinct edge to the city. And that was important to the client to maintain this idea of identity. The buffer area is divided into three systems. There's what we call program landscape, which would be recreation, hiking trails, ball fields, things like that. Agricultural or production landscapes, which is where they would grow different types of foods and vegetables. And then the functional landscape, which is for stormwater management. You can see a more extensive diagram of the stormwater system here. Because we built on the ridge lines of this particular site, the site essentially sheds water into the valleys, which are then used for stormwater treatment. And then it gradually is cleansed as it moves down the valley. So the bottom of the valley would be used more as a wildlife and habitat recreation zone. And then we would use the shelves of the hillsides for the agriculture. Here's one of those valleys. Again, this is pretty close into the city center, which is here to the right. So this is a fairly manicured picture, a manicured landscape. It probably in reality it's going to be a little more naturalized than this. And then the client, along with their fascination with vertical farming and agriculture, was very interested in programming the actual food production on the site. So we have been working with them to designate different portions of the site for these different uses. These are the terms that they gave us, the romantic flower garden, the berries and fruits garden. So they have really interesting, in particular, thoughts about this stuff. So this is an overall view of Great City. You can see where the agriculture is placed, and then the stormwater management in the valleys. And as you get closer to the city, the spaces are more programmed for recreation and things like that. Lastly, last two themes, innovative architecture. We've been studying the particular configurations of all the parcels. There's really three or four prototype parcels. These happen to be what we call the district center parcels. We also have looked at the valley parcel design. And as I mentioned, one of the criticisms from the client right now is that the architecture needs to be advanced. So we're probably going to spend the next 2 months really just working on the design of the buildings, because we feel like the planning of the city is fairly well along. The last theme is adaptable implementation. One of the criteria the client gave us, just like every project in China, they want to do it now or in the next year. So we've been talking to them about how to build this stuff quickly, how to minimize impact on the site. This shows a cut and fill diagram through a typical hillside condition. So here's the ridge line, here's the valley, and the lighter brown represents fill area. So we basically balanced cut and fill on a typical cross section on the hillside, and we said, okay, that's how we're going to manage cut and fill, because we didn't want to cut the tops of the hills off and dump it all in the valleys, which we just spent so much energy trying to conserve. So the ridge lines are actually going to get higher so that those connections so those ridge lines will actually be exaggerated. And what this does to address the client's request for sort of vertical separation in the city is it creates alternate layers of pedestrian movement. So we have bridges connecting what we call the podium level. We have the actual street level proper. We have the service level, which is below that. We have a valley level, which is a few steps below that. So there's all sorts of ways to move through this city, not just on the street, even though we do want the street to be very active and vibrant. So lastly, in terms of construction sequencing, we actually aren't calling it phasing, we're just calling it sequencing, what comes first and second and third. But we're looking to work with some of the Japanese and Chinese construction companies on prefabrication of setting up typical modules for formwork. So anything we can do to sort of shorten the construction sequence. So right now we are, as I mentioned, in a design refinement phase. We are moving towards a presentation to the mayor of Chengdu in June, and he will give it his blessing, hopefully. And then they're very close to actually buying the site right now. So hopefully all those details will be tied up. Then finally, just a couple last... We're always struggling with how to frame the sustainable story, but what we're doing is simply tracking a few key statistics. The city is 7 times more efficient in terms of the use of land than a typical Chinese urban zone. And then here are some other reductions we've been able to achieve. I think the one thing I'm really excited about is we're able to divert about 94% of waste from landfills and recycle that material. So that's a great city. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Peter. We're all going to have to do our presentations for each other afterwards. We can't quite see the screen. It sounded very interesting. Do I change my presentation?
I think so, too. Can we do that? Hey, LaVon? Can we move and watch from there? Okay.
All right. Initiative, that's good. Well, thank you very much for the invitation to be with you today. I spent so much of last year away that it's so great to be back with friendly faces that I know and to be able or be asked to actually come talk about the projects that we're doing in places that you think nobody ever hears about or really cares about. And maybe that's right, I don't know, but that's a real treat, so thank you very much. So I took maybe a little different approach to the discussion this morning. You know, I kind of resisted the urge to drill down into a lot of kind of SOM project work and more kind of reflected on the people I know are in the room, that we have diverse interests. We have, you know, attorneys, land developers, we have educators, we have civil servants, we have architects, planners, the full gamut. So I thought maybe it would be interesting to kind of talk about the experience of being in India, kind of what I learned there and culturally, and then we'll go through some project work. But I want you to kind of reflect on your day-to-day interest in what you do, kind of your impressions of what we're seeing in India. So not to be too tutorial here, but I thought it would be interesting just to do a little overview of growth dynamics. I know everyone knows this. You know, we've got a real issue here, folks. We're not getting smaller. We're expanding in population. That puts tremendous pressure on our cities. It's a great challenge for us to think about cities of the future, how we can accommodate more people, how we can do more with our infrastructure, with fewer natural resources and are softer the way that we live on the earth. But beyond that, also, it's really engaging to think how you can help people have environments where they can thrive and really have fantastic active life. So India is very proud. They just completed a huge push to do a national census. The numbers were out last month, so I have a few of them here. You know, 1.2 billion people are the ones they counted. There's probably another, you know, 500 million somewhere hiding somewhere. But what's amazing here, if you look what happened over 10 years, basically they took everyone from Brazil and brought them to India. Their population grew by 181 million. And then if you think forward to 2030, which is tomorrow, you know, India is actually going to outpace China in terms of its growth and its population. So, you know, again, most people may know this, but when I went there, I really didn't have in my head spatially how India compared to the United States. So, you know, I assume we all recognize this. It's 6.5% of the world's surface area, but we have 4.5% of the world's population. But if you overlay India, it actually, you know, spans from Montana down to Mexico. Let's call it Colorado over to Pittsburgh. So about a third of the U.S. land area. So, you know, 2.4% of the world's land area with 17.5% of the world's population. And then I'm going to have to step back to read here. I don't have these memorized, but we looked at kind of density per kilometer. And so in India, you're at 382, and you compare that to the United States. The best figure I could find was around 73, 73.5. But then in Delhi, in particular, the most populous area, you're at 11,000 people per square kilometer, compared to Chicago at 4,600. You may have a better number. Number for New York's about 8,800. So, you know, it's a real city. where is this growth occurring? You know, it's primarily in the northern band, in the Delhi, the largest state there, Uttar Pradesh, and then in the core central area of the country with Mumbai, and then all of the tech and IT growth that's occurring at different densities, a different kind of life there, a little better climate through the central part in Hyderabad and Chennai. So if we kind of then target Delhi, and I'll say that's primarily where I've been working. We're doing a lot of work in Mumbai. We're doing work in many places, but my practice has primarily been working on projects in the Delhi area. So I thought we'd spend just a minute here and kind of look at the growth dynamics of Delhi. It's the same conversations we have here when we talk about growing and expanding in these dynamics. So we have old Delhi. You know, it started with the little dot over generation or over centuries. That's where Shah Jahanabad or Old Delhi is located. It's the Red Fort. And then, you know, here come the British and, excuse me. Get it together. I have some images. Cool. So here's the old Delhi, you know. There's where all those people actually are, and, you know, the beautiful environment. Beautiful people steeped in tradition and culture. Really a great spirit. That's what I would say about the people there. Really excited about the future, interested to, you know, learn and to do better. Tradesmen, businessmen, great religion. And then mixed in, you know, with all of that beauty, and that's kind of a theme that we see, it's kind of order and chaos. Right next to that, no separation. You have people whose, day-to-day in life may be a bit different from others. Then here's Lutyens with the growth of New Delhi, which was a beautiful, you know, urban plan, which introduced, you know, kind of European order to the city. So this being India Gate, the beautiful state complex, our national complex, kind of the European-inspired but Indian architecture. And a first really great mixed-use project. It's kind of the postcard for retail in the country. It's Connaught Place, and it had some rough years, but with the Commonwealth Games that just occurred, they've really been renovating. And what's great here, or a challenge, you know, everyone in India says about mixed use, you can't put residential above commercial. And that's a real challenge when you want to do an active environment. When you think about all these people that need somewhere to live, that's kind of an artificial mindset. But here, this is the most expensive residential property value in Delhi. You actually live above your store here, and people still live there today. The other thing, you know, being in a kind of a desertous region, you don't think about how green a city could be, but Delhi's one of the greenest cities I've ever visited. It's truly amazing how things can live with a little water. Okay, so in terms of growth dynamics, many may have heard of Gurgaon, the big international airport, and this was just renovated, was built in that area, the road there, so that's where all of the large format, kind of their first experiment of growing out of the city for large office uses. But unfortunately, many consider it's a success from a business standpoint. That's where all the expats, the big corporations are. But in terms of an urban environment, it's an absolute disaster. No concept about connecting streets, no concept about understanding where doors are, major malls, no concept of traffic. You get big, huge residential projects that are there. They're about to add another, I think, 400 acres to continue to grow south of that. So this area continues to grow. And they really didn't have the utility and energy infrastructure to do it either. So every one of these large buildings have diesel generators in the basement. They truck in two tractor-trailer loads of diesel every day. They burn that. And when you look at carbon emissions, that is just off of the charts. So we can say more about that. This is the old road to Agra, and if anyone's ever been from Delhi to Agra, you know this is a real joy. It's about 2 hours as a crow would fly. It's about 6 or 10 if you're in a car trying to drive it. It's just a disaster. Kind of a theme that I'll talk about are these major, major public infrastructure projects that are actually funded and built by the private sector. They operate them for 30 years, and in return, they get large grants of land that are starting to lead to large-scale development and speculative cities. So this group is actually building, you see the red line, the new expressway to Agra. There is a major regional planning authority with a vision for a second airport before future, but as you can imagine, it has everyone's imagination, and growth is indeed happening out along this corridor. And what a great opportunity to try to get it right. So they are really trying to look at regional planning. They're having hard conversations about a new transit system, how that could reorganize land use, connectivity, and bring populations, and a better thought about how to deal with energy. So just a few observations and challenges. I love this. This was my client's gift calendar. It was on the wall. It was a different piece of famous art every day. But it really, you know, you're always aware that you're dealing with a society that, you know, has 5 years of kind of unchanged existence. Many of us in our heritage, we had kind of a prophet, a messiah, some big something that happened a couple of thousand years ago. You know, here, this is a tradition that's shared around campfires and villages, and you start, I was going to get smart. I bought a Jackie Collins reader to Hindu gods. I was going to figure it out. And you can't figure it out, because here's what it is. It talks about a family member in the third incarnation and someone's cousin and this. They're beautiful parables that would address anything that you would face in life. So it's just a great thing to reflect. There are different ways to think, different ways to kind of make sense of the world you're in, and you know, you accept it and you work with it, and you might even learn something. This is big, you know, 5,000 years of civilization, 65 years of democracy. Think what we were doing 65 years into our existence. I mean, this is the public pastime. The passion is to debate each other, to say when someone's messing up or sometimes when someone's having a good idea, and to really to watch here and to be a participant in the process. So that's a very exciting thing. And in contrast to maybe other places we'll hear about today, there is such a belief in property rights and personal rights, so they don't take land. They respect small parcels. You have to work around property owners and villages, which is complicated, but in the end of the day, maybe it's even richer. So we have a huge growing middle class, so, you know, developments are starting to look a little more spread out, a little more green, some would say a little more sterile. But then, you know, alongside of that, with these growing aspirations, are resources to actually do things like buy cars and need to go somewhere. So you hear these horrific figures of 10,000 new automobiles in Delhi every month. That is not sustainable. I mean, that's a disaster. And they're smaller and they're smarter. They have compressed natural gas infrastructure that all of their public transport runs on, and that's all great, but you'll never win with those kind of numbers. A tremendous thirst for knowledge, education, innovation that is at every level, whether it's becoming literate in a village or whether it's aspiring in upper-class families to go on and have that great education, to going abroad, to coming back to India and doing something with it. And unlike anywhere I've been, the family and tradition is such an essential part, a cornerstone of the society. You know, if you've ever been to a Hindu wedding, it's a little embarrassing. They get mom on stage and talk about procreation, then brother comes on stage and talk about procreation. and so forth and so on. And, you know, so you have these massive families and a passion, a desire. It's your role, responsibility to start having children immediately and to contribute. And all these things I'm talking about have direct impacts when you get around to doing planning, when you get around to architecture and development and working with the earth. So these major infrastructure projects, they've introduced now for the past, I think, 7 or 8 years, they've started constructing their metro stations, their commuter rail stations throughout the city, and they are world-class. They're fantastic. And what would take you hours to get through traffic, you can go across the Metroplex in 25, 30 minutes. It's amazing. They have a cultural hurdle to get over because, you know, developers say, well, no one I'm going to develop for is going to get in a public transportation. No one's going to take the train. But you know what? People are taking the train, so, you know, we kind of have to get over that hump, but it's a bit of a challenge. So this is the system is in place. It's a diagram. They have a next generation that's envisioned to go all the way down to that future airport that I showed. Then this, not a beautiful map, but if you follow the red lines, the blue lines are the river, the Ganga River or Ganges River on the north, on the south, the Yamuna River, and major new interstate highways to link these major urban centers. And the purple dots you see are the land grants of, you know, 5,000, 10,000, 15,000 acres. So everyone thinks, you know, well, if I have land, I have to do a city. Well, it doesn't work that way. You have to be able to get to it. You have to have jobs. You have to have other kinds of investment. And the impacts on the land are pretty significant. And then on all of this modernity, you know, you still have a little bit of real world here, all mixed in with it that has a real implication in the design of the physical realm. And what's great is where they're really, we haven't seen a lot of environmental policy. That is a growing passion and concern. They have rallies. They have large groups that come out and clean the riverbanks. So, you know, it's kind of been a mentality if you put a bund, a levee around your development, and as long as you're not flooded or drowned, you know, sorry, someone else has to deal with their problems. But that's really changing to understand it as all a connected system. But this development is putting tremendous pressure on the beautiful farmland that's around and the people. So here's a compressed natural gas pipeline coming through, you know, what was formerly a village and an area. So excuse the word slide, but, you know, this is really where it gets tough. It's them trying to figure out and work through and look for good ideas how to get things done. So unfortunately, right now, they are looking around the world for the best practices, such as from us in the United States, about how we did our cities, our land use plans, our regional plans, our transportation in 1976 or thereabout. So everything big, huge standards, and you have all these people packed together. Who are we to say that you shouldn't try to spread out a little bit and have a little more light and air? But there's a tipping point where it makes no sense, and unfortunately, they're 500 miles beyond tipping point. So we are getting incredible parking standards. I'm doing a project I'll show you here. We ran the numbers. I have to have 60,000 parking spaces. In Singapore, I would need 13,000. In Chicago, I would need 25. So imagine 65,000 parking space, 40,000 above what you would say was sane today. And then massive setbacks. Everything's, if you're residential, low-rise, you're here, you have a 50-meter setback. If you're group housing, you're multifamily, you have a 50-meter setback. If you're commercial, you're over here, 50-meter setback. Disaster. And then finally here on street design manual, literally from 76, and add to that, forgive me, UKers, but they have a UK traffic system, so they drive on the wrong side of the road. Okay, we can deal with that. But it's they have divided roads, roundabouts, so you'll have to, you want to cross the street, you'll have to drive a half mile, turn around, and drive a half mile. So you've driven a mile. Now think about 10,000 cars a week times this, times that, times fuel, times air quality, times, you know, it doesn't work. So just ideas about crossing the road are huge. Okay, in terms of projects, Mumbai, I'll just flash, you know, a few big guys up here. This isn't my deal, but we are very proud that we are participating in building the nation's next generation of infrastructure, so the new international airport in Mumbai. But then maybe kind of as fun of the projects are helping to imagine kind of blighted or slum areas or underutilized neighborhoods or forgotten kind of wastelands along their water and floodplains. for kind of interesting new ways to think about neighborhood regeneration. This is a project that actually kind of cleans an area along the ocean where the river comes into that in Mumbai, restores wetland biohabitats there, and finds an architecture that can kind of reach and engage that while allowing it to still act as the floodplain that it is. So I'll spend just a few more minutes here. This is the project that took me to India last year, and it was amazing experience for many reasons. I took about six people over there. We set up an office. It was fantastic. We're 12 hours separated from Chicago, so my phone didn't ring. I didn't get a stupid email. Nobody walked in the door. You could sit there with a pencil and draw all day. It was absolutely amazing. And about 8 o'clock at night, look out. Everybody's up. So our client was actually building this road between Delhi and Agra and had several land grants. And so the one closest to the city that's actually kind of the growth boundary in the national capital region was a site that we looked at to guide development. It had very irregular parcels here. There was future ring road plans that had to come through, which provide great visibility and connectivity and add van value. But how do you make something out of kind of an irregular area? And then, before you figure all of that out, they're in construction here, a Formula One racetrack. It opens in November. Who knew that there is an international raid? People like that stuff. So the world's flocking now, to JP City for the first Indian national race event this November, and a professional cricket stadium. So never mind if you're a sports enthusiast. Think about the people that this would bring to your development, to your city as a major draw in the area. And this would be linked by the metro commuter rail system that we talked about. So, after a little bit of work, we actually drew through 350 million square feet of development and helped them understand how they could take that down, obviously, over a very long multi-year time frame. And kind of the big idea here was with the irregular parcels and the separation was to find a way to make it not three kind of weird things, but actually try to add up to a city. So here we introduced, a novel concept, a boulevard. But it's more than that. It's a park boulevard, so that it's actually a feature that we can use to manage water on the site, that we can expand, contract, we can program different kinds of rooms and characters all along the city so that there are actually amenities and neighborhoods that the development can grow around incrementally over time. And, we spent a lot of time trying to be smart, but then you have to be kind of dumb at the same time and ask the basic thing. So where's the hot wind coming from? Are there ever nice, cool winds? How should streets be oriented so that, I really just have the short sides of my buildings oriented where I get all the sun on the east and west? And if you kind of get that right, then maybe you have a chance to do some good on an upward battle. If you don't get the basics right, it's challenging. So just a couple of images here. This was the idea for the downtown center around the large major park adjacent to the F1. Idea about how we do neighborhoods. And, I look at that boulevard diagram, and I spent many years working with the village of Riverside, and people always think, kind of that approach to a city. But when you layer that onto the kind of density that we have here, there's really not a project like this that I know of. It's kind of amazing density. For example, in the park is one of the amenities. This was one of the larger ones, kind of event and activity space. And the owner, insisted on having some surface water. Of course, that evaporates. Bad idea. You don't want to do it. But maybe in a couple of places. So we had strategies in all of our area where we actually have large kind of flat box culverts under our lakes and in areas. We capture every drop of water. We take it down. We store it. We design it to maintain a low level. But then we have the ability in our infrastructure during monsoon season, wherein the country gets 90% of its year allotment of water within 2 months or less, you have to have a place to store it. So the park and the boulevard allowed us to do that. Of course, passionate about university and hospital campus uses as part of that. Obviously, approaching it from a water management standpoint, I've kind of covered that, but that we wanted to do not a pipe-based system, but wanted to find ways to actually let water hit the earth and actually soak in and be filtered naturally and return it to the aquifer. Terrible slide, you can't see it, but this, if I'm bringing something back to Chicago in the United States, this is where I just land right now. And we don't have this luxury necessarily, but there are lessons here about how you would think about a next generation of utilities. And so here, you know, we had the advantage to be able to do a physical plan where we could imagine service districts. And within those districts, we could balance commercial to residential use so that you offset peak load demand so you can get kind of a balanced load. And then we looked at waste to energy systems. So, you know, in nature, there's no such thing as waste. Waste from something is energy for another. I'm doing a speech again. But so utilities can do that, too. You can take the waste from one system, your sludge from your water treatment plant. It goes into something that makes methane gas. The methane gas, you know, so forth and so on, can be used to generate electricity. So actually thinking about co-located utilities and what those next systems are, getting away from huge central plants, but actually trying to power and care for nodes of development as they come online. And we did several business models with people a lot smarter than me that actually did the calcs for this, but you know, the number one thing they could do to immediately cut carbon emissions from business as usual in India was to engage natural gas. And there's not natural gas in India. It's a new technology that's just being a new infrastructure being installed. So I think that will have huge transformative benefits. And here we go. This is amazing. What did I live in October. I went back. I went online. You can see the city. Like in, you know, a few months, they're actually out there building the thing. So that's pretty exciting, too. And just very quickly, just a couple of slides. What are we working on today? I've got this great client that's in town. We're doing workshops. He changed the meeting date to today. It's like, well, I'm busy this morning, but I'll take you with me. More of an urban infill kind of scale and project. So here it's imagining a way to insert 35 million square feet of major mixed-use development into an existing city center area, designated city center area, and it's the last stop on the metro. So the government's held this site to the very end. They've let all this crazy development, low-scale development happen around it so that they then could get the metro out there and then cash in. Okay, that sounds good. So this will be kind of the largest land sale in India's history with almost, you know, with several Bs on the price tag. So, you know, we go through, we work in model a lot, we try to imagine what that would be and work through it. And the design is not what I'm talking about. This is, you know, a month old. It's just starting. It's the conversation that's mind-blowing. So we're allowed 3.5 gross FAR on site. We can build this kind of business as usual. It's a family of 10, 12-story buildings, 18, 24 special buildings, 35. Maybe you get 150. Oh, no, that's not the way we do it. Sure, we may be allowed 3.5, but in India, there's a fluff factor, so we can do another 10%. And then, okay, what does that look like? Oh, okay. Well, but, you know, we actually can have another 10% for things that we don't really count as usable area. Okay, so now all of a sudden, you know, this is what we're looking to build. So it's a 35-story buildings, 50-story buildings, 70-story buildings. There's no building like that in India. There's a 65-story that's approved in Delhi. It's not out of the ground yet. You know, so these are the ambitions. These are the discussions. And what happens with this? Well, I have 2+2 roads around it. I need 7+7 lanes of roads around it if I do that. Or maybe I could actually do streets that go through with signals about every 400 meters, and about every 200 meters I can have secondary streets. Where's Tim Dorn? Did he leave? Isn't that right, Tim? All right. You know, no concept. No concept at all. So, you know, it's bridling ambitions. It's imagining spaces after you get out of this conceptual world that give people places to be with their families, that take on the hard infrastructure, that take on the hard environmental issues, and sum up to something that makes a great life. So, you know, this is short. We should keep talking. But, you know, what do I bring back to Chicago? What do I think about? I'm not convinced that we can sit here. Oh, I've got a beautiful office. I never want to leave the office. But, you know, we're not building a lot of cities here. So as a practitioner, you kind of have to get out there and do it, and that's hard. But it's really rewarding. And so what could you bring home, and how could you think about engaging in the global marketplace? It has me challenging scale in the U.S. I don't think we have it wrong, but I do think we're kind of spread out a bit. And, you know, we've all been talking about it for the past few years. We call it different things. But, you know, how do we rethink scale in cities? And then the next generation of infrastructure. Every time we flush a toilet, we turn on the sink, every drop of water goes to the Gulf of Mexico. Insane. Okay, we have existing infrastructure that's in place and utility systems, and we can't just tear them out and start over because we're lofty. But the day will come, and we need to be thinking ahead about how we take incremental steps to do things differently so that we're stewards of the earth in a responsible way, too. And finally, maybe this one is more for Chicago than abroad, but people are different, and that's okay. Thank you.
It's just this one right here, right? Great. That was amazing, Richard and Peter. I just want to thank you for having the opportunity to come out and share our projects with you. When Jackie asked me to do this, her question to me was, you know, so how did you start working overseas and your international planning practice? So that's pretty much the theme and the thread of today, sort of the journey to get there. I think what you've heard from everybody is that we're all within an architecture sort of umbrella. I work with Solomon Corbell Benz, and I'm the principal and director of planning. That's created a kind of interesting dynamic, and especially during the recession, as we saw a lot of our projects stop suddenly, and so we looked overseas, and I think that's what happened with a lot of the firms in Chicago. In terms of looking at what our core values are, I think are really, really important when we go to export our planning expertise overseas. We have to think deeply about it because we're not just bringing and transplanting, you know, a little bit of America there. We actually have to take and digest what the culture is, and you know, and be able to look at that from you know, the client engagement and having those dialogues. And the collaborative planning process. Sustainability is really key to everything as we look forward, and this planet's getting smaller and smaller with all our resources. And design is more of looking at the cultural values and what you choose to design and how you design them. And then civic life is extremely important in anything we do, is to make sure that there's always a civic life as part of the project. So that's what we sort of bring to our planning practice. These are the projects that we've worked on in the last 4 years in the Gulf, centered around the countries, and probably mostly the petrol countries, I'm afraid. But that they are the United Arab Emirates. In Abu Dhabi, we've been working with them for 4 years now. To Doha, we did some competitions for the airport there. Recently with Saudi Arabia, and working on an industrial city for a new economic city. They have 6 economic cities that they're promoting right now and putting their resources in it at a regional and governmental perspective. Just so you know, just to remind everybody, it's a big place. It's amazing when you look at the size and the distances. You know, Saudi Arabia is about 20% of the land mass of the United States. Abu Dhabi is a small place, and the Emirates is a small place along the Gulf. Our whole sort of venture into the Middle East started with some relationships that we had with the engineering community. I think that, you know, as you look at development, the first things to go in any developing country is the infrastructure. And, you know, in the Middle East, it's many cases, it's water and sewer. Desalinization is what the whole Emirate is pretty much running on. And they've got it down in a way. And so that was quite impressive for me to see how they deal with water in a desert environment. Everything we did from the landscape point of view had to be balanced in terms of you know, how much public space you have, and if you can water that from your treated sewer effluent, and so that was part of the whole vocabulary of what we had to rethink the public realm. And I think that's something we can bring home, too. But roads, my goodness, roads will start the whole process and understanding how the infrastructure works there. We also have been associated with areas where they're putting in a new airport or a rail line. So this is the United Arab Emirates, and you can kind of see from the distance from Dubai to Abu Dhabi is about 60 kilometers. When we first got involved, we actually went over for the Tall Building Conference in Dubai and went to go visit the little emirate of Abu Dhabi. Little did we know that it was the most of the landmass. As you can see, that's the yellow portion there is Abu Dhabi. They have the deepest oil wells, and they actually bailed out in their sovereign fund the debt in Dubai. So very conservative emirate. About 5 or 6 years ago, the father of the country died and left it to his three sons. And the current sheikh is much more concerned about sustainability and sort of changing their worldview. They established the Urban Planning Council, who we work with. They are an amazing organization. When we started, they were about 20 people, a lot of Canadians, a couple Australians, and a few Emiratis. And they grew to over 200 people in the 3 years that we were working with them. And so it was interesting to watch a bureaucracy kind of bloom in front of your face. But they also were trying very hard to transplant all the best practices they could into their system of organization. You have to remember with Abu Dhabi that in 1971, it was the Trucial States. It was at that point they received their independence from Britain and became the United Arab Emirates. They have a Bedouin history and tribal relationships where there's different groups and families. They migrate from the sea in the wintertime to the mountains in the summertime, and they have oases where where there's an aquifer and they have their only indigenous sort of long-term structures are these forts that still exist from dating back hundreds of years. Well, this is Abu Dhabi today. It's a booming metropolis. It's a little less than 1 million people. The emirate itself is about 1.2 million. Most people live in the urbanized area. It's got a lot of amazing new construction on islands outside of the main island for downtown. It's got a lot of congestions, wide streets, and it has a zoning code that came back from the mid-70s. Which gave it sort of a uniform look to you either had the 6-story building, the 8-story building, the 20-story building, and it had a certain setback, and they sort of were cookie cuttered all around. So that was an interesting notion for us to think about, okay, now what are we going to do when we have to do design guidelines? So as we went through this is the main island of Abu Dhabi. It's about the size of Manhattan. It is built out. The palace areas and things like that are along the southern side of it, so it's low scale there. The downtown core and more of the higher density is at the corniche at the end of the island. And so they had this land preserve, which was here, is about 10,000 acres. The airport is along this area here to the north, and Masdar, which you might have all heard, is their zero carbon city, has gotten a lot of notoriety. They were to the north of this project. When we competed for this and won the downtown portion, there were many teams working on this. Is the area in yellow? Our role was to look at the development of the high-rise housing components of the project. I'm really not doing well on this. Okay, and then this is actually a 3D model that's been put onto the existing aerial, and you can sort of see the development area that we were focused on. We worked with the team. A lot of the radial patterns and sort of Baroque planning of the capital district was done earlier before we got onto the job. Our job was really to focus on creating the downtown centers, the neighborhoods, the components of the plan. This area was subdivided into 17 different precincts, and each one had a sort of balanced housing, job ratio, cultural facilities, schools, and we had many different requirements on the land side. Okay, and this is a view looking down the main avenue of the city, and then this is a computerized model that we did, and eventually was built into a model about half the size of this room, which they had for a cityscape. They love these big shows in Abu Dhabi. Okay, and then we did a lot to look at development of, you know, the different components of the plan, and making sure that wherever there were public space, that it was well articulated, and that it had a lot of special character and attention to the urban design components. We had to put together for each of the, I think there were 17 or almost 1,700 parcels. We had to do design guidelines for each individual one. It's a much different land tenure system, where each parcel is then given out to an Emirati citizen who then hires a developer, and that's how the process goes. Now, I have to tell you, on this project, it's been stalled for quite a bit after the Dubai bailout. They've slowed down. They have started on the metro system that would run underneath it, and they've built one stadium as part of this this plan. But it's going to probably, what they think they foresaw is happening in a few years, I think they've got a few decades to work on. But you know, we also looked very carefully at urban space and how to develop the parcels throughout to be active and to incorporate those inviting sort of landscapes. That they would also, again, this is, you can see we have a lot of sort of areas which are less green and than you saw before in different climates, but making sure that there's a balanced water strategy for everything. We also had a process of developing prototypes, building prototypes, so there's a whole transect of different building components, starting from your lower scale to your higher scale, and how they would work on their individual parcel placement. And so we had a whole, we created a focus on where each one of these components would be located and their specialties. Now, from Abu Dhabi, we then were involved in a competition for Doha Airport. This is a regeneration of the current airport land, and they were at that point considering moving the airport. And so since that point in time, it has not taken place, but it was our segue into meeting and working with the development company in Kuwait, who then are now working on the Saudi Arabian city of Hal. Now, Hal is here in Saudi Arabia, and you know, Saudi Arabia is about the 20% of our of the U.S. landmass. This is Abu Dhabi and the United Arab Emirates over here, and it's in the what they call the empty quarter of Saudi Arabia, mostly desert. But it's very ancient. It's along the original Silk Route and trading route that came through here. It's also on the Hajj path for the pilgrims coming through. They expect about 1 million visitors to come through the Hajj as they work on their rail alignments in coming through this area, and as they go to Mecca and Medina. And then I had a special requirements of what I got to wear to work when I went to visit the site. You know, Hal is this is the landmass. I think you've seen a whole bunch of like crazy, you know, land parcels in terms of what happens. But this is north of the city of the ancient city of Hal is about 8 kilometers to the south. There is a new highway under construction, which is this dark line here. There is a new rail line under construction. And through here, and there are some amazing sort of outcroppings of rocks. It tends to be a kind of mountainous area, and through here, a university is currently built in this area here. This whole area is 158 square kilometers of land, and that was a very daunting task for us to look at. We surveyed the site, and we spent about 3 days going through every area and making sure that we understood the grading. We got some grades preliminary at that point in time, and realized that they had a Singaporean company look at this earlier, and they had like I think 3 million. Square meters of 300 million square meters of land movement that was going to be required in this major parcel here. And we sort of said, well, what does that mean? And that was about 200 Sears Towers or the Willis Towers lined up that had to be moved. And we said, okay, well, that's going to take you about 15 years to do that. So at that point, we convinced them that we had to create a more naturalistic way to look at the site. And so we in this area here, we found a little bit of a valley. There was some wadis that run through the site, which are like storm water creeks and drainage areas. Again, these are some of the views of the land in through here. And why this area is really so special is that it sits on a very large aquifer. They do have wheat production and some other farming in the area. There's also bauxite there. So they have a smelter. Alcoa is building a smelter there. But Saudi Arabia has a very interesting phenomenon right now. It's a population of about 28 million people. About 45% of the population is under the age of 15. And that's a pretty scary thought. And so they need to think about what they're going to do, what kind of jobs they're going to create, and where people are going to go. And they don't want them all in the Riyadh region. They want them in other places. So places like Hale are a place where they can have... it's not everybody is getting paid for being on the dole for in petrol money. They need jobs and they need education. So this is part of their plan. And so I think for me it was a great experience to see that part of Saudi Arabia we hear it as kind of an evil empire, but it's just a developing country and it's got some very difficult politics obviously. But So this is the land plan that we finally came up with for our industrial city. Now, we worked with a number of engineering companies. A company called NACO did the airport. They're out of the Netherlands. There's another company that was doing the dry port, which is where the rail alignment took place. And then this is the downtown core. The train station was being planned and developed at this location. This was around it was sort of your medium-sized density. And then this was more of a residential zone, taking into effect it was kind of a plateau sort of mountain. And then the water naturally drained through the site through here. This is another wadi that ran through the site in this area here. So from that, we started looking we had to come up with the first phase. What would that be? And that was 28 square kilometers. That's what the developer was committed towards. And they were working for the Saudi Arabian Investment Corporation. So then we had direct meetings with them, most of the time in Kuwait, but we also did that in Riyadh. So this is the boundary of the airport. This is all sort of industrial lands. And then again, we spent a lot of time working on what is that the neighborhoods, the look and feel, the place like. And I think this is where we tried to create a kind of hybrid of the boulevard street and the eco boulevards as a way of creating waterways throughout and moving the water eventually to, there's a couple of culverts at this location and this location. And then this area here was where the train station was, and eventually that would be probably an industrial zone in the future, but this was within our first phase of development. And as we kind of drilled down to the components of it, you can see this is the train station area. They really love having circles and radial patterns. And it was interesting. We tried to convince them a few times out of it, and it was a symbolic core to them. And so this is the train station. There's a mall, which a tourist zone for during the Hajj. Their downtown core. There were some tower developments for the developer that would be their first phase. And then we worked on where the potential alignments, although it's a long ways away, for transit-oriented development and the civic centers. And this kind of does a blow-up of one of the residential zones and the sort of eco boulevard that ran through it, creating places for recreation and centers where you had your mosque, your schools, your recreational fields. We also had to have neighborhoods that could be Saudi and segregated, or they could be mixed, because they didn't know where they were going to be in the next few years. So that there is a good percentage of the population would be expat. They call them expats, but they're primarily a subcontinent, and the workers that would be part of the composite. And so keeping separation was something that they were never sure where they were going to be. So we always had to look at, was there potential for a compound or not a compound in the way we put the streets together, but we wanted to make sure they were as walkable as possible. And then this is a view of one of the neighborhoods. I think what's really important to think about from our perspective is that there's an opportunity in these areas, and there's a tremendous amount of need. But we really need to focus on what we bring to the table and how we create that hybrid that takes into cultural issues, but also ideals for what makes a great place to live.
As Nan prepares his presentation, we've got about 20 minutes. We're going to let Nan go, and then we'll open it up for questions and answers, and try to conclude from 10:05 if we can. Thanks.
Hi. Thank you. I'm with VOA. Thank you for the opportunity to talk about this presentation. VOA as a firm, we start working in China in about 2005. And right now we have two offices in China, one is in Beijing, one is in Shanghai. And this master plan was done actually in 2008. And the reason we show this project, I thought it's very interesting. It has very interesting background, and it's related to a lot of different parties, and also it's has a very interesting process. You know, China in the past 20 years has been go through the very fast growing mode, and a lot of cities building the new cities, like Chengdu, they're building the new cities, high-rise building things like overnight. And there's crane everywhere, and actually the overall population is not growing that like India. You know, they have one child policy, and where all these people came from, actually all these people came from the rural side of China, and they're farmers. And right now all those modern technology, they don't need that much farmer to farm on the land. And each village, they probably have 10 people charge the whole land. They used to use 300 people. And all these people, they went to the city to find a job. They work in the construction site, the retail, the service industry. So all these people, they need housing. That's why that's the force behind a lot of these new cities and the new construction. This project actually are... it's one of the sample. This urbanization movement, it caused a sort of decaying for those rural towns. You know, these towns used to have a farmer and they have farming communities, but since a lot of people they move and into the city, live in the city, so this town starting to not really dying, but they're not very very well alive. So this town we're doing the master plan actually is just outside of Beijing, you know, the central core of Beijing. And right now, all this yellow and green area is used not belong to Beijing. It's used to be their own county. But right now, the Beijing became larger and larger. They incorporate all this county into their own municipal district. So this town called Tanjus Town is in their Mental Go district, sort of just the west side of the Tiananmen Square. So you can see this is about 30 kilometers directly west, west of the city center. Well, this town, we thought is very interesting because it has a very mountain-like setting, and the whole town is in the mountain. Beijing is a city. on their east and south side is pretty flat. So they label the east side and the west and south side sort of like their CBD growth area and their industrial. But their north and the west all covered by the mountains. So from the city central planning standpoint, they want the west and the north side to be sort of like very eco-development, very green, very resort-like setting. So this town, Tanjus town, is on the west side of the city. It has very long history. The reason is there's Tanjus Si, means Tanjus Temple. The temple was built in Jin Dynasty. It's about 1600 years old temple, and it's very old. There's an old saying says, there's a Tanjus Temple first, then the Beijing City later. And someone had the old saying, someone did the Beijing City, old city planning, looking at the Tanjus Temple plan, and draft their Beijing City plan. So anyway, and also this town is in the mountain area, and it used to be, there's not too much of farming in this town, but they used to have a lot of coal mining. And it used to be a mining community. But since lately, you know, during the Olympic Games and all these environmental issues, the city government, Beijing city government said, you know, you cannot do the coal mine just directly next to our city center. So they basically shut down all of the coal mine. And so the people over there, they kind of lost their jobs. And the people who had the capability to work, they all moved into the city center, and what left is those older people and the children, you know, like those grandparents take care of their kids. But total town population used to be about 10,000 people, but right now it's about only 1/4 and 1/5 people left in the town. And also it has very nice courtyard, sort of Chinese traditional neighborhood like. This master plan, we work with many people. You know, we have to deal with the local government. The local government really want the developer to come in to provide the job opportunities to make the town come back again. And they don't want people just to come here, build houses, sell them, and go away. They have to make all sort of program, commercial, residential, and culture. And for the developer, of course, they want to build as much as possible, make profit. And the interesting is the chairman of this developer, his home is in Sunnyvale, California. And he really likes there, and he has this dream. He wants to build something like that outside of Beijing. And that's the first meeting he told me, you know, we really like Sunnyvale, California. And of course, as an architect and planner, we want to create something very unique, rooted to that community and to that environment, and create a really sustainable master plan. You can see that the whole, this is the area map of the whole town, and it all covered by the mountains. The only flat piece left is sort of in that side boundary. This is the side boundary we get at the very beginning. And it's about 200 hectares, something like that. And we were giving this side boundary. We said, okay, well, we'll work with that side boundaries. And that yellow line is the only way from Beijing to get into the Tanjus Temple. And so sort of follow a local road. Currently, if you get there from Beijing, it's taking you about 2 hours because you have to cross the mountains and go up and down. But actually, Beijing City is building another state highway and goes through the mountains through a tunnel. If that was built, I think right now it's been built. It's from the center of the Beijing to the Tanjus Temple. It only take you 40 minutes. So it's not that far. It's not that far. So that's the site area of the initial site boundary. No, we look at the site and we look at the mountain all around. And there's a two canal used to be on the site. And but through the year during the coal mining, the water get lost and there's just a dry trench. on the site. And with the two canal meet, there used to be a reservoir there, but right now it's all dry. And there's a section cut through the site. You see there's only sort of flat land in the whole town. Now that's where we did initial thought about where to build first the facing. During the process, we actually found out, and the chairman of this group and also the government said, no, we don't want you only do the flat land, and we want you to take a look overall the picture. Tanjiao town had a total 12 villages, and we want you to do the master plan for the whole village, for the whole town. We said, well, where is the site boundary? Where is the site boundary we're going to work with? They said, well, you had to find out. And you can see there's a major town center sort of like lower end. That's where we used to have the site boundary, that flat piece of land. But when you go up in the mountains, there's a total 12 villages. And those 12 villages, they're pretty high in the mountain. And some of the villages, they have no people living in that village. And because, first of all, they don't have that water supplies, don't have electricity, and the people started moving down and live in the town center. Also because a lot of labor force went to the city to work there. So their villages became sort of abandoned villages. But we have to literally went through each of the villages to see which village we can use and what we can put in there. Also, it's not only the village, maybe the area surrounded by the village, maybe there's some place we can use. So each village are very interesting. They are, some of the villages are 300 years old. They're all built by the limestone. And the housing itself, the main structure is still there. And it's just nobody lived there for a long time. So you go through the grass, this tall of grass, and go through each of the villages. Feels like you are stepping in a movie set. But this is each of the villages. You see, for each of the village, some of the villages there still have a lot of people to live. But some of the villages, something like this one, is totally abandoned. You see the tall grass. But the village itself, is preserved pretty nice because it's all built by the local stones. It has a very nice character. So we went through each of the villages. We thought about the topo of that village. We kind of surveyed each village for the site boundaries, and we're thinking about what we can put into that village. Some village could be really nice for the high-end hotel, and some of the village could be renovated into really nice high-end housing. In some of the village, you can put some like club there, and it's a very interesting journey. So this is the other several villages. You can see they have very unique characters about those pathways, the walls they build the village, and the really beautiful natural setting and where they're located in the mountain. Okay. And this is another several other villages. So in the end, so sort of we expanded the site. This is mainly focused still in the lower ground. And you can see the site got significantly larger. And the total population, the planned mass plan for the total population is about 40,000 people. Yeah. So we have some master plan goals to create a really high-end residence to provide the civil functions and also balance then the sustainable resources. And we have set up the planning principles. That's the basic diagram where the town centers, where the buffer area, and where those remote residences. And we look at the different density of the housing from the less dense to a little bit more dense condos. And we look at samples, you know, from California about how we do the town centers. Really want to create something really nice, pedestrian feel sort of town center environment. The Sunnyvale, California, and several other samples. You know, the city center in West Palm. And we also suggest to put in some of the music halls and the museums. Those different functions. And then we did some early studies. We could take some inspiration from some ideas, linear connections, and this amphitheater sort of idea, so the focus in the town center. And this sort of organic idea, it could be like different clusters of the plan. And finally, we end up the final mass plan. It's like this. You see the whole site boundary got very, very large, very big, much larger than the original site plan we used to deal with. And it's waved into the mountain. Even the highest remote village was incorporated into the overall master plan. And we're trying to create this neighborhood sort of everywhere. You go to the commercial retail is in the 5 minutes walk zone. So we connected all the historical paths and also their heritages by the walking paths, also trying to restore that original canal and restore that river pond, the water pond when they meet. And this is the right zone is where each of the village are, so we sort of the master plan incorporate original village into the new master plan. Now that's the traffic route, and we have the major highway, and we connect with the major highway. And we also talk about the parkings, and you know, the parking could be combined with the underground parking, with the street parking, and the greenway system. So we really create this huge park connected all the pathways and the different neighborhoods. Yeah, this is the zoning for different neighborhoods. And also in this master plan, we have to specifically designate the zone for the local farming community. And the goal is to attract those laborers went to city back into this town and provide housing for that. That blue area actually is specifically for their replacement housing, because you are using their own village to do something else and you have to build a housing for them. And we work with the developer and calculate the jobs we can create. And by this master plan, we can create around 5,000 jobs. Yeah. So that's the different zoning and the final area, FAR. And I think totally in the end, we have about 480 hectares of total planned area. And the overall FAR is around 0.65. So it's sort of like really nice, low density, walkable town, and create this very lively neighborhood. So those ones are, we just take each of the key components, did a little bit more analysis. This is the town center. Those are the different neighborhoods. No, the riverfront housing. Okay. Yep. We can quickly go through this. It's about, and yep, those are all the villages. We have some ideas. You know, this could be some type of like a really high-end retail. And this just combined different factors into the whole master plan. The sustainable strategy, and that's just the town center image. No, in the end, when we did the presentation, and someone came up like, "Hey, that looks like a dragon." Then everyone was so happy. Yeah, yeah, that looks like a dragon. So, yep, thank you.
I apologize. I hate to cut you short because we asked each of our presenters to come with about 20 minutes worth of slides, and obviously they could have each spoken for 2 hours because they're so excited about the work and what you're doing is so remarkable. So at this point, I'd like to invite the speakers to come up. We do have a present for each of you. It's our Chicago Burnham book. We ask that you take it back to United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia and China and India, and if your clients want more, we'd love we won't sell them. We'll let you take them. Anyway, thank you so much. Anybody who can stay and ask some questions, we'd love to. It's 10 o'clock, though, so if people have to leave, we certainly understand. But once again, thanks to Levon and Jackie for putting this together, and thanks to all of our presenters. I think what they're doing is extraordinary, and I think all of us are a little bit overwhelmed by the scale of their development. So thanks once again.
Once again, we are recording this, so for any of our members or friends that have not attended today's event or any of our events, you can get it online.
Yeah, this can be to any of the speakers, but what is the ratio of condominiums to rental apartments? And the second question is there different housing for different income levels, such as, you know, and we have as Section 8, for example?
I can start off on that. On all of our developments, we had an initial economic report that was done based on what the projected income levels would be, and in the work with the Capital District, we had different rankings in terms of the number of apartments that might be considered service apartments, which it could also be for professionals like myself or something. It would be in that category, and then there were different criteria associated with that. In Saudi Arabia, it was a much finer grain because it was based on the different industries and what they would. What their workers would be required. We had everything from they called them like gray collar, blue collar, white collar, you know, sort of those old terms from the 1950s. But it told them what slice. And I think in the end we kind of culled it down to about six different levels of income brackets, and then there was different housing types associated with it. I do not know, you know, how many we're going to actually own or how many we're going to rent. In the end, I think it depended on your status as a citizen, as to whether you were allowed to own.
I'm curious to know what kinds of housing the people are coming from to live in these communities of communal living, so to speak, and if they're more dispersed from in terms of where they're coming from, what sorts of counseling or planning or whatever there is to go into living in such dense areas?
Well, some of the housing that I've seen in China, especially, and I'm sure in India, is very substandard by any normal measure. Usually it's open sewers, maybe running water, uninsulated, nothing to code. So a lot of these folks that are moving to the big Chinese cities are coming from rural housing, rural villages that really have absolutely no construction standards whatsoever. So this is a sort of a step up for them. I'm not personally aware of any sort of counseling, is that what you asked? Or
even though it may be substandard living, it's a little more individual,
right.
You know, and coming
right.
together to live in a congregate situation,
right.
There are different social dynamics beyond the physical environment that come into play?
Yeah, I've never heard that question raised, actually. The Chinese, in my opinion, are highly social, sort of a very strong family structure, so it's never been an issue that's been raised on any of my projects.
Yeah, from my personal experience, I think the in China, people get used to living in the high density and mixed use. You know, here we're trying to create a mixed use development, create a high density city, but people over there, they already doing that for a long time. And as long as you build something, there's always the retail at the lower base, and there's always an active sidewalk. It's just a retail, like, all along the sidewalks. And another momentum I found is very interesting is young, for Chinese, when they, young professionals, or when they, after they just get married, they have a very strong urge to own a property, which is not the same here happened in U.S. Here, people, you know, you can afford, you buy a property. If you cannot afford, you rent. But over there, even you cannot afford a property, they will try everything, save every penny to own a property. That's how the, you know, all those housing development, they sold quickly. Like they opened the sales center, all the housing sold overnight. And that's just unbelievable.
I'd say a bit in India, you know, it's still a little uncomfortable because, I mean, people are living close together, so that part is not a challenge. But from a developer standpoint, people still want to have a high-end product, a medium-end product, a lower medium product, a low product. Everyone has their place. Everyone has a separate entry. We do these city plans. We don't think about it, didn't think about it, but they're looking at it as though there's going to be a gate on every street with a gatekeeper. They're going to know who walks down there. You're going to have to pass the test, and if you don't, tough. You know, so I think they're in kind of what I'm hoping is kind of an incremental step towards a better way. There's certainly more options in housing. The people are moving from, you know, tight housing to nicer housing. These were nice communities that we showed, but there's still that segregated mentality. It goes to the malls. There's a nice mall next to a medium mall, next to a low mall. You know, everything that you can talk about has its little slot or groove that you're supposed to fit into. So it's an interesting dynamic.
Richard and the rest of you, for those of you who have been to one too many angry public meeting in Chicago or the suburbs or anywhere else in this country where you have people who are not only saying not in my backyard, but we don't believe in height or density or anybody encroaching on our single-family home. Has your experience working overseas changed your idea about public participation in the planning process?
Well, you know, I can say it's a more efficient process. you know, we did venture in on some public process in the UAE, and it was interesting to see people who are not sure if they should speak out in the meetings. Right. So it's different, it makes you appreciate the kind of environments we live in here, where everyone does feel that freedom to speak out and talk about all the issues that they are concerned about. I just think that that's an evolving aspect, and it maybe that's one thing that we should be thinking about, you know, in bringing to the process. It's hard when you're working for a developer. I think it's a little easier with some governmental agencies to talk about that because they want to change their culture a little bit too.
Yeah, I think the public process is basically non-existent in China as far as I can tell, which is fantastic for us. But in the Middle East, when we did the master plan for the Kingdom of Bahrain when I was working at Skidmore, I think we held one of the first ever public meetings, and they didn't know what to do because you do have class issues, you have tribal issues. You know, now with all the current conflict in Bahrain, that's rising to the surface. But people are afraid, sometimes afraid to speak up. Sometimes they don't feel like it's their place. Sometimes they feel like it's not their job. So there's a whole, there's, it's not, nothing like it is here. you never get the type of meetings you have here.
Yeah, typically in China, it will involve a lot of government officials, right. And they will come in and question your master plan. And I know right now in Shanghai, I think they started doing the public, not the really public hearing, they put your master plan on a huge billboard on the site. And it's by law, it has to be there for 3 months. If you have a problem, you better to speak up now. After 3 months, they pull down the sign, they start construction.
Since you all seem to be building housing that's targeting the middle class in these different countries, what is the average size of the housing that you're planning on developing?
I'll say in India, I was kind of surprised that they have very specific building code regulations, so you get what we call octopus buildings. So every room in a residential unit has to have light and air, every bathroom, every kitchen, every maid's quarter, everything. So you get these long, weird bars, and then they're notched out so you can get light and air in there. It becomes very hard to make a street wall with them. They're kind of these objects in a park, so we've really been trying to reinvent or introduce some new ways to do things like hold a street wall and to bend them. But the family sizes are much larger. Add to that the servant ratio. So, you know, we might say 2.5 or 3 people here, and then you size for that. We're talking 5 or 6 as a base. That translates into office as well. You have many more people in an office environment, very small quarters, but you have the tea boys, the coffee boys, the this, the that, and you have these huge populations. So in India, the units are a little bigger, and they expect light and air. They expect to have, you know, 9 or 10 foot ceilings. So you're crammed in, but you have bigger spaces.
How about elevators?
There are elevators, and here's what's great. So I don't know what an elevator is. I want to go up, right? So I want the elevator to come down. So I push the down button. I hadn't quite figured that out yet. That's great. About 1,300 square feet for a base unit. There are some service apartments that would be in the 900 range is what I've found, but it's different in other places. Panelists.
In the UAE, it's very interesting because it's only 10% of the population are nationals, so 90% are expats basically, and so they've been encouraging them to grow their families. So they have 5 kids on average, they usually have 11 to a household, which includes their servants. And then they live in clan arrangements as much as possible so that you could have... And they do have the option of having up to 4 wives, but most of them don't in the modern world. They say it's just too much trouble. So... So from that standpoint, it's a much different family structure, but that's only for a small percentage of the population. There is a tremendous amount of expats that are coming from India, Pakistan, every political exile that can be possible, looking for work. So many of them come as single young men. There's a huge group of women that come to fill the nursing trades from the Philippines and to do the child's daycare services, so there's many different slices of the way the structure and the housing works. So you could have everything from dormitory life to corporate apartments to a family unit. And some of them bring their family eventually, or they grow into positions where they can bring their families. There are people who've been there 30 years who are not citizens, and they're originally from India or something like that, and that's pretty normal. So it's a much different kind of housing market than you can ever imagine, what the needs are.
Yeah, in China, I think. Most of the commercial developers tended to build larger units because they can make more money. Since the housing price going up so quickly and there's units became luxury and large, the central government literally issued a law, I think about 3 years ago, that every development has to have a 70% of units less than 90 square meters, which is about 900 square feet. And so if you want to build a housing development, you have to build 70% of units at smaller units. But in the end, those developers always can figure out a way. They can, you know, put the units two by two together after the inspection, they knock down the wall, they sell as one unit, and they always figure out a way to deal with the law. But there's a tendency to have a smaller units built for the average family. Yeah, right now it's only one child per family, so average is three people per family.
In for the project that the last project in China that was the speaker, is that temple part of? Excuse my ignorance about this, but is it part of like a UNESCO or World Trade Heritage or any designation like that?
I don't clearly remember. I think it is part of the World Trade. Yeah, World Heritage. I'm not sure it's officially designated, but it's certainly been there for a long time, and it's very famous in Beijing. Yeah, that's a really nice temple. They have two trees in the temple, ginkgo trees. Each one has a thousand year, already been there a thousand years, so really old trees. Mm.
Again, a round of applause for our speakers. And again, I apologize for cutting you short because I know we could listen to you all morning. But thanks again, and thank you to thank all of you for coming.
Thank you.
Good.